the greatest century of missions. Our desire is to put feet to our faith, and we need to learn from examples of excellence. The inspiring lives of the 19th century missionaries refute the anti-Christian propaganda predominant today. Educational institutions and many governments around the world are enamored with Islam and other Eastern religions. From so many sides, we are being bombarded with guilt, manipulation, disinformation, news media, entertainment industry, school textbooks, all over the place. But facts are stubborn things. And the inspiring lives and incredible achievements against all odds by bold and brave missionaries of the 19th century expose the fallacies and the fraud of these malicious, ignorant assertions that all too often you hear. I've been at missions conferences now for as long as I've been a Christian, for over 42 years. And the amount of times I've heard at missions conferences, people berating and slandering and absolutely disgracefully attacking the missionaries of the past, like we would have done better under their circumstances. And the extraordinary hostility to the missionaries that you hear from so many, and yet it's even depicted by Christians. I was at GECAWI, Global Consultation World Evangelization, 1997, one of the biggest mission conferences ever. The first act on there, the first thing after pitch darkness, strobe lights, and some rock music, which I don't know what that had to do with worship, they had a skit where they portrayed David Livingstone as an imbecile. And, you know, if one of the greatest missionaries Africa's ever seen was a failure, then why don't the rest of us just pack up and go home? You know, what hope do we have of doing any better? And this is the kind of nonsense at missions conferences. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and prudent in their own sight. The greatest century of missions exposes the reality of heathenism, which confronted these pioneers of the gospel. It kicks the legs out from under these Marxist myths and the slander of the saints and seeks to rewrite history. The spectacular achievements of God-fearing Christians in confronting cannibalism, child sacrifice, widow burning, and slavery need to be understood. Do people understand what those missionaries in the 19th century confronted? The missionaries of the 19th century steadfastly resisted the Islamic slave trade and set many tens of thousands of captives free. David Livingstone is honored as a liberator. We need to make these eye-opening exposés of what Africa, the Middle East, and Asia were really like before the gospel came and became widely known in the area. And how much we are indebted to the sacrificial service of those dedicated disciples who laid down their lives and laid solid foundations for the future. When pioneer missionary to Persia, Henry Martin, sought to present his Persian New Testament to the Shah, he was challenged with an ultimatum to declare that Muhammad is the prophet of God. And when Henry Martin boldly refused and asserted instead Jesus Christ is the Son of God, his opponents were enraged and they threatened to have his tongue torn out for blasphemy. When Robert Moffat first applied to the London Missionary Society, he was rejected. His proposal to marry Mary Smith was also refused by her parents. Yet Robert persevered, and on his first missionary expedition to South Africa, he succeeded in bringing to Christ the most notorious bandit and murderer in the country. Finally, Mary Smith's parents relented and gave permission, and Mary sailed to South Africa, where she is married to Robert Moffat, and for the next 50 years, the Moffats became one of the greatest husband-wife teams in missionary history. Robert Moffat succeeded in being the first to translate the complete Bible into an African language at Kuruma. And this was the first printing press north of the Orange River. He picked it up in Cape Town, took it to Kuruma, and started to print out school textbooks, catechisms, Bibles, Pilgrim's Progress, many other great things in Tswana language. The church that Robert Moffat built can seat easily 800. You can see Robert Moffat is the third of the missionaries to have served under London Missionary Society LMS at Kuruman. But look as you come down and you see, David Livingstone. For 3 years, David Livingstone was based at Kuramantu. He became Robert Moffat's son-in-law. Robert Moffat journeyed far and wide and conducted several great missionary endeavors to Madibeeland, where I grew up, in Bulawayo, to Lubengula and Mzilikazi. He spent 50 years, more than 50 years, in the field in Africa, based at Kuruman from 1820 to 1870. Fast writes at visionary. It was his vision of the smoke of 1,000 villages that have not yet heard the name of Christ that inspired David Livingstone to switch his focus from China to Africa. David Livingstone was preparing at medical and theological school to be a missionary to China, but it was Robert Moffat's report back from Africa that made him switch, and praise God he did switch. I'm sure he would have been a blessing in China, but it's hard to imagine David Livingstone being more effective anywhere other than Africa. When Great Britain was the greatest economic and military power and spiritual power in the world, Queen Victoria was asked by a visiting African prince, what is the secret of England's greatness? And Queen Victoria presented him with a Bible and said, here is the secret of England's greatness. In fact, the spires of these great cathedrals, this being Salisbury Cathedral, the cathedrals of Britain are great and they point to God. They point to the highest authorities, and the greatest architectural achievements in history are the cathedrals built to the honor of God. Samuel Zwemer chose to oppose Islam, and he resolved to engage the enemy on the soil of Arabia, the birthplace of Muhammad. If we want the 21st century to be the greatest century of missions and revival, then we need to learn from the Christian pioneers whom God used to make the 19th century, that's 1801 to 1900, the greatest century of Christian advance so far. In 1801, Protestant Christianity was concentrated in Europe and North America. Except for some small Christian enclaves, Asia was almost untouched by the gospel. There were significant Christian communities in Egypt, Ethiopia, and Sudan, and a small number of Dutch settlers at the southernmost tip of Africa, but otherwise, Africa was unevangelized. However, by the end of the 1800s, by 1900, Christianity was a world religion, with churches established in almost every country. And here's an Operation World map showing the brighter the yellow, the higher the percentage of evangelicals, and the darker the red, the lower the percentage of evangelicals. But you can see how by 1900 the gospel had penetrated throughout the world. How Christianity became the first truly international religion in just one century is an amazing story. What inspired these incredibly effective missionary pioneers and the successful strategies that they used needs to be prayerfully examined if we are to be more effective in world evangelism. While the 20th century can boast greater numbers of missionaries in the field, greater numbers of converts, the 19th century saw far greater depth of impact for the gospel. Especially when we consider the very limited resources which was available to these pioneers, and the overwhelming difficulties and dangers and obstacles which they had to overcome, the missionary pioneers of the 19th century clearly present the most inspiring examples of Christian courage and perseverance against all odds. The incredible adventures of these soul winners, these nation builders, these culture shapers makes for exhilarating reading. The exploits and achievements of these extraordinary Christian heroes and heroines have mostly been forgotten in the countries where they were sent from. It is for this reason, perhaps most appropriate, that this book celebrating some of the adventures, sacrifices, and achievements of the missionary pioneers comes from Africa. For it is we in Africa who have benefited so greatly from the 19th century missionary movement. In this time of secularism and skepticism, some may be surprised to hear how much these missionary pioneers are honored in Africa. Dr. David Livingstone, for example, has two towns in Africa named after him. Livingstone in Zambia, right by Victoria Falls, which he named, and Livingstonia in Malawi. Other towns in Africa which were named after Europeans, such as Stanleyville, Salisbury, Elizabethville, Fort Victoria, they've had their names changed. But Livingston and Livingstonia remain as a tribute to a man who brought faith to the hearts of Africans while he struck fear into the hearts of the slave traders. Livingston is known as a true liberator in Africa. In fact, some years ago, we did a reader survey of our Christian Action magazine throughout Africa. Who's the greatest African of all time? And interestingly enough, while Shaka Zulu and Cleopatra were on the list and so on, number one was David Livingstone. African correspondents voted David Livingstone as, by a far margin, far and away, the most respected name in Africa. While the statues of many colonial figures like Cecil John Rhodes have been toppled and removed, you'll be hard-pressed to find them. Even at the university he founded in Cape Town, you can't find the statue of Cecil John Rhodes anymore. But statues and monuments to missionary pioneers like David Livingstone continue to be built. When we went to Livingstone, Zambia back in 2013 for the 200th anniversary of the birth of David Livingstone for the Livingstone 200 conference, I counted 8 monuments to David Livingstone in the town of Livingstone. And some had just been built that year. And they just built a new one 2 years before at the airport and so on. So this reflects their prominence and reflects the deep respect which Africans still have for Christian pioneers like David Livingstone. Now, there have, of course, been many concerted attempts to discredit the memory of early missionaries. Karl Marx declared, "The first battlefield is the rewriting of history." And have his disciples been busy rewriting history? From the time I was first converted to Christ, 3rd of April, 1977, I have heard the most vicious slanders against the 19th century missionary movement, even at missions conferences. At one of the very first missions conferences I ever attended, student consultation on frontier missions, I heard a missiology professor from Stellenbosch, Dominie Nico Smit, declare, "The missionaries did not believe that black people had souls. They taught that Africans were the firewood of hell." Now, at the time I was a new convert, I didn't know very much about anything. But what he said sounded so outrageous, so self-contradictory, that in this plenary session of hundreds of people at a missionaries conference, I actually stood up, which I didn't realize at the time how totally unacceptable that is. But I stood up and I challenged Nico Smit, "Which missionaries taught this? Did David Livingstone or Robert Moffat teach us?" He looked surprised and said, "No, not them." "Did C.T. Studd teach these things? Did Mary Slessor believe these things?" I asked. Nico Smit began to look uncomfortable. No, not them. "Well, which missionaries believed and taught this?" I said, "Because I don't understand why anyone would have come to Africa to be a missionary, many of them dying of disease here in the field, if they did not believe that the people of Africa were souls for whom Christ died. Didn't many of the missionaries die bringing the gospel to Africa? Why would they have done that? The average life expectancy of a missionary to West Africa was 2 years. Some died within 3 months of arriving. This is the grave of Mary Livingstone, David Livingstone's wife, who died at age 36 in Tet Province in the Zambezi Valley." This university professor, Nico Smit, never answered my question. He drifted off into some anecdotes about some heartless church members he knew who had bad relations with people of other races. What on earth does that have to do with the missionaries in the 19th century, who opened up Africa for the gospel often at the cost of their own lives? Now, although I didn't know much about God's law at that time, I had this uncomfortable feeling I'd just heard someone bearing false witness against Christians of another era, who were not present to answer the slander. You know, it's pretty cowardly to make a football out of our spiritual fathers. And it's super easy to score goals when the other team's not on the field. Have you ever tried that? Or you can score a lot of goals if there's no team opposing you. There's no challenge, is there? And this is what they do. These arrogant, self-opinionated speakers stand up and slander the people of long ago who cannot defend themselves, and the people present don't know enough to be able to refute them. I've always been interested in history. And when I was converted to Christ in 1977, I was overwhelmed with the conviction that I was called to missions. From the day I heard the gospel, I was called to missions at the same time as I was converted. In the 42 years, I've never doubted that. I've always been something of a bookworm, so I naturally tended to gravitate towards history books. And as my knowledge of missionary history increased, I was astounded at the general ignorance of the church concerning their heritage. I was also most disappointed at the tendency of so many speakers at so many missions conferences to disparage the missionary pioneers who had laid the foundations for the church in Africa. I could not help wondering if these speakers really thought that we would have done a better job had we been in their positions, with the few resources they had, facing overwhelming obstacles and dangers that these missionaries confront, would we have even ventured in the field? And I venture to guess most of them wouldn't. I've come across major Bible institutes in this country where the missiology professor has never done any missions. What on earth's worth is that? Having someone teach you something he hasn't done himself, would you be interested in having a coach train you for a sport they've never done themselves? It's balachlik. Hindsight is all very well, but pioneers do not have the benefit of the hindsight of anyone who's gone before, because they're the pioneers. As I ventured into the mission fields of Mozambique and Angola and Sudan, my respect for these missionaries has only increased. I was reading Livingstone's travels while retracing much of the steps in the Shiri Valley of Malawi and the Zambezi Valley of Mozambique in the mid-1980s, as I was doing primary research for In the Killing Fields of Mozambique. In 1989, I was captured by communist troops in Mozambique and flown by Russian pilots in Soviet Mi-8 HIP helicopters to Tet. And I was intrigued to see how Livingstone's description of Tet back in the 1850s could accurately have been applied to Tet in 1989 as well. The devastation from the Arab slave traders, which Livingstone recorded in the Zambezi expedition of 1858 to 1864, could have also described much of the scorched earth campaign of the communist Frelimo government and his Soviet allies in the 1980s. On another occasion, as I was driving down some of the worst roads I've ever experienced in the Shisheke area of Zambia, I remembered some of the trials and tribulations of David Livingstone in that very area. As I've regularly had to remind the young volunteers of our mission who complain about the bad roads, David Livingstone walked where we drive. And he had to walk across an Africa that had no roads, no bridges, no shops, no hospitals, neither was clean water available. As Livingstone reported after his first missionary journey, I've drunk water swarming with insects, thick with mud, putrid with rhinoceros urine, and buffalo dung. Hacking his way through dense rainforests, walking for days in pouring rain, totally drenched with his equipment, either rusting if it was metal or rotting if it was canvas, Livingstone persevered across the continent. Hostile tribes demanded exorbitant payment for crossing their territory. His life was often in danger from Muslim slave raiders. He was mauled by a lion, charged by rhino, laid low with fever on over 60 occasions. The afflictions that Livingstone was called to endure while opening up Africa for the gospel and opposing the Arab slave trade tested the limits of human endurance. Leeches, maggots, putzi flies, cholera, pneumonia, sunburns, huge sores, tropical ulcers, and malaria plagued him. Yet his indomitable spirit rose as he set his heart to accomplish goals which seemed humanly impossible. He persevered, and as a result of his sacrificial labors, the Central African and East African slave trade was exposed and eradicated. David Livingstone's example was used by the Lord to inspire many hundreds of men and women to devote their lives to African missions, like Mary Slessor, for example, whose elder brother wanted to be a missionary to Calabar, but he died in his youth before he could go. Her next brother died. He was going to take place, and so she realized, I must take the place of my brothers. They were going to go to Calabar. And she went. And Dr. Kenneth Fraser from Scotland was inspired to go to Muraland in southern Sudan, which is where our missionaries had our mission base. And we have seen how the Christians in Muraland have endured scorched earth, terror bombings, destruction of the churches, aerial bombardment campaign by the Arab government. Yet they stand firm. Just to test me to what a phenomenal work that was done by Dr. Kenneth Fraser in training these Moro people. And he trained them, he drilled them, he had them doing PT every morning at 6 in the morning, the teachers, the nurses, the evangelists, all of them. And when we went there, we found the people were having their conferences out in the forest because their church had been bombed and destroyed in the town. It didn't stop them. They kept going. Although they were on the front line of the battle, even though they were being severely persecuted for their faith. And the biggest project our mission had ever done up to that stage, 1998, we delivered 10,000 Bibles in Moro, the first Bibles in the Moro language, to the people of Moreland. Here's the church that Kenneth Fraser built. It's been destroyed 3 times, rebuilt each time. Some of the disciples of Kenneth Fraser, and close to this sign here, the Bible translator Ezra Lawiri, who's one of his disciples, had just completed translating the Bible into Moro. He's on his way to get it printed. He got killed in ambush close to that side. And it was my joy to take him those Moro Bibles in 2001. And while we were delivering these Bibles, we were bombed on Sunday morning at the church service. And what clearer picture could there be that the Bible is a message of life and death? Some people love the Word of God so much they're willing to die for it. Others hate the Word of God so much they're willing to kill to stop it. Some of the bombs exploding around church while we were under attack there. Some of the shrapnel you'll see in our reception area that we picked up from that that day. Not only did we not lose anyone, we gained people. There were more people in the church after it was bombed than before. And the highlight of the service was presenting them the first Bible in the Moro language. The Bible that had started to be translated by Dr. Kenneth Fraser. He did the Gospels and Acts. His disciple Ezra Reary did the rest. And we had the privilege of delivering them to the people. This church has lost 5 hours, despite being bombed at the beginning. They didn't allow bombing to keep them from continuing the worship service. So these people in Moreland, their faith is a direct result of David Livingstone's seed sowing, an example of excellence. As this soldier here said, this happened to show the power of God. The Bibles of the Christians are more powerful than the bombs of the Muslims. And today the Moro people continue to be one of the most literate and evangelized people, evangelists, the backbone of the chaplaincy, heart of the resistance in South Sudan, really good people, good friends. And we continue to minister amongst them. We must pray for Western Equatoria and South Sudan, area I've been talking about throughout time here. Jesus Christ said, on this rock I will build my church and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. But modern detractors of the 19th century missionary movement like to brush aside the historic realities which the missionaries had to confront. And they prefer to paint Africa before the influence of the gospel as idyllic and utopian. Kenneth Gunda, one-time dictator of Zambia, wrote in his book, A Humanist in Africa, that the people in Africa knew nothing about suffering until the missionaries arrived. Interesting, he said, I could not agree with the Calvinist faith of my parents. His parents had been trained at Livingstonia in Malawi, and his parents were Reformed. He said, I could not accept the Calvinist teaching on the holiness of God and the depravity of man. I don't believe in the sinfulness of man. I believe in the goodness of man. I'm a humanist. And he made socialist humanism the prevailing ideology of Zambia, one-party dictatorship, which hosted terrorists who were going into Angola, Mozambique, Rhodesia, Southwest Africa, and South Africa. And he locked up many of the people who disagreed with his government in Lusaka Central Prison. I was also there in cell 11 with a lot of people who ended up being the next governor of Zambia, including General Godfrey Muyanda and Frederick Chiluba, who was also locked up there. And Kenneth Kaunda, when he was locked up in this prison by the evil British, he had 3 cooked meals a day. He had a cell to himself, blankets, sheets, mattresses, sofa, desk, chair, access to the library, electricity, plumbing and all that. When we were locked up in these cells, he was Kenneth Kaunda, a humanist who believed in the goodness of man. He had 1,200 people in a prison the British built for 80 people. There was no electricity, no plumbing, only 1 cooked meal a day, only with starch. The only protein came from the flies. And in Lusaka Central Prison, when I was locked up in there, there were 60 to 65 people in a cell, and we had no bedding, no mattresses, no beds, no plumbing, no electricity. So isn't it interesting how the people who believe in depravity of man can be so kind to people, and the people who believe in the goodness of man can be such vicious, nasty, abusive dictators. According to dictators and humanists like Kaunda, all Africans lived in peace, harmony, tranquility, and prosperity before the missionaries arrived and ruined everything with the gospel. Now, you might expect such ahistoric ramblings from committed Marxists like Hitler Hunsvi here, who was leader of the expropriation without compensation farm invasions campaign in Zimbabwe. This man, by the way, was a dentist who liked to strap his enemies into his dentistry and drill their teeth out without anesthetic. So that's the kind of man that Mugabe picked as his man to lead the land invasions. Here's the Malema of Zimbabwe. He died of AIDS shortly after beginning this, though. Now, you might expect people who hate the gospel to say this, but incredibly, all too many Christians, because of the ignorance of history, repeat these allegations even in Christian publications. But what was the reality of heathenism? Mary Smith was horrified when she arrived in Calabar to discover that a woman who gave birth to twins was regarded with horror. And the belief was that the father of one of the infants was an evil spirit. And the mother had been guilty of a great sin to bear twins. And as at least one of the children was believed to be a monster, so both twins were seized, their backs were broken, they were crushed into calabash or water pot, taken out not by the doorway but by a hole broken in the back wall, which was once again built up again, and they were thrown to the bush where they were left to be eaten by insects or wild beasts. Mary found Calabar in the grip of rampant witchcraft, drunkenness, immorality, and slavery. She intervened to prevent a witch doctor pouring boiling oil over a woman who was staked out, spread-eagled on the ground, and cannibalism and slavery between the tribes was widespread. Once when instructed to heal a dying chief, Mary knew if she failed, she'd be blamed for his death. And often this is what happens. The witch doctors get all they can out of the people, and when a person's just about to die, they send them to the missionary or to the local hospital that they can blame them when they finally do die, after they've enriched themselves with everything this poor family's got to offer. Well, first Mary got rid of all the witchcraft charms and the sacrificed chickens lying around the hut. Then she prayed. She gave the chief good medicine. She nursed him back to health. The wives of the chief were particularly grateful for Mary's success because they would otherwise have been killed and buried with the chief if he had died. Because a woman's usefulness ended with the death of her husband, so widow burying, widow burning, very common. These wives are understandably keen to learn about the book which had saved their lives. Samuel Marsden, the pioneer missionary to New Zealand, witnessed the depth of degradation and the hold of superstition of the Maori people when the widow of the deceased chief hanged herself with the approval and applause of her parents and brothers. Can you imagine parents encouraging their child to commit suicide, brothers encouraging their sister to commit suicide? This is the hold of heathenism at that time. Cannibalism was rife with the Maori. One chief declared he had eaten 139 people. Now, he couldn't count, but he had kept a bone for every person he'd eaten, so they were able to count up bones and say, "I've eaten 139 people." One woman confessed she had killed and eaten 19 children. Missionaries to the New Hebrides found human sacrifice and cannibalism rife throughout the Pacific Islands. In Fiji, two-thirds of all children were boiled and eaten by their own parents. Every village had a human butcher. Aged parents were butchered and eaten by their children. Men would even cook their best wife or child as a special feast for their friends. It's absolutely mind-numbing to realize what the world was like before the gospel got there. John Patton, missionary to the New Hebrides, reported on an occasion on Tana when three women were killed in a human sacrifice to secure the recovery to health of the chief. When missionary to the South Sea Islands, John Williams, was criticized for imposing foreign Christian standards upon unwilling communities living in primitive bliss, John Williams noted, "These are the same communities, same societies, where laziness, promiscuity, human sacrifice, and the burial alive of infants had shortly before been commonplace. Far from the missionaries interrupting the peace and tranquility of pagan nations, the missionaries came to nations that were passing through immense upheavals. When Hudson Taylor first landed in Shanghai in 1854, the country was being torn apart by a vicious civil war, the so-called Taiping Rebellion. Rebels held the city. 50,000 imperial troops besieged it. The house that Hudson was staying in Shanghai was struck by cannon fire. The house next to his was destroyed. Imagine doing your language studies under that kind of bombardment. He frequently witnessed people being beheaded. He himself came very close to being lynched on occasion. Over 25 million Chinese were killed in two civil wars that raged in the 1850s and the 1860s in China. Another 10 million died just during the famine of 1877 into 1879 in the north of China. This is the reality of the world before the gospel arrived. As Dr. George Grant states in the introduction to Grace Central Missions, as missionaries moved out from Christendom to the uttermost parts of the earth, they were shocked to discover all the horrors of untamed heathenism. They found abortion all too prevalent, infanticide all too commonplace, abandonment all too familiar, euthanasia all too customary. They were confronted by the endemic poverty, reoccurring famine, unfettered disease, widespread chattel slavery, cannibalism, ritual abuse, patricide, that's the killing of parents, human sacrifice, sexual perversity, petty tyranny, paternalistic exploitation, children treating your children like slaves, live burials, exterminative clan warfare, and genocidal tribal vendettas all predominated. As missionaries circled the globe, penetrated the jungles, crossed the seas, they preached a singular message: light out of darkness, liberty out of tyranny, life out of death. To cultures endemic with terrible poverty, brutality, lawlessness, and disease, these faithful Christian witnesses interjected the novel Christian concepts of grace, charity, law, medicine, and the sanctity of life. They overturned despots. They liberated the captives. They rescued the perishing. They established hospitals. They founded orphanages. They started rescue missions. They started almshouses, homes for the poor. They opened soup kitchens. They incorporated charitable societies. They changed laws. They demonstrated love. They lived as if people really mattered. Wherever missionaries went, they faced a dual challenge: confront sin in men's hearts, confront sin in men's cultures. And the obstacles, the dangers, and the difficulties that they had to overcome were staggering. By an act of British Parliament, missionaries were illegal in India. In China, not only was all missionary activity completely illegal, so was attempting to learn the Chinese language. There was a ban on any Chinese teaching the language to foreigners. The Chinese tutors to Robert Morrison — Robert Morrison was the first Protestant missionary to China — these tutors, the translators, carried poison on their bodies so that they could end their lives quickly and escape torture if they were captured. Chinese torture is renowned. Because at that time the Chinese forbade foreign women, Robert Morrison had to live apart from his wife Mary for most of their lives once he was separated 6 years. Now, I've known people complaining about being separated from their wives for 6 days. 6 years? That's pretty serious. America's first foreign missionary, Adnan Judson, was captured in the high seas, and he was incarcerated in a French prison, from which he escaped. Later, he was imprisoned and tortured in death prison in Burma for 18 months, where they were strung up by their feet so that only their shoulders touched the ground every night. David Livingstone wrote in a letter to his sisters, "We need to be uncommon Christians, that is, eminently holy and devoted servants of the Most High. Let us seek that selfishness be extirpated, pride banished, unbelief driven from the mind, every idol dethroned, and everything hostile to holiness and opposed to the divine will crucified. that holiness to the Lord may be engraved on the heart and evermore characterize our whole conduct. One mission organization wrote to David Livingston asking, "Have you found a good road to where you are? If so, we want to send other men to join you." Livingston replied, "If you have men who will come, only if there's a good road. I don't want them. I want men who will come even if there's no road at all." C.T. Studd, the famous cricket captain turned pioneer missionary, declared, "If Jesus Christ be God, and if he died for me, no sacrifice can be too great for me to make for him." You know, today, a great Christian witness in sport is someone who prays on the pitch. C.T. Studd gave up being the greatest cricketer in Britain at a time when Britain had the greatest cricket team in the world, and he gave it up for missions to China. As he suffered malaria and other attacks, C.T. Studd wrote, "Some like to live within the sound of church or chapel bell. I want to run a rescue shop within a yard of hell." In the words of C.T. Studd, Christ's call is to capture men from the devil's clutches, to snatch him from the very jaws of hell, to enlist and train them for Jesus, make them a mighty army of God. But this can only be accomplished by red-hot, unconventional, unfettered Holy Spirit religion, by reckless sacrifice and heroism in the foremost trenches. The challenge of David Livingston rings out today. Can that be called a sacrifice, which is simply paid back, a small part of a great debt owing to our God, which we can never repay? It is emphatically no sacrifice. Say rather, it is a privilege. Studying the sacrifices and the exploits of the pioneer missionaries of the 19th century is most challenging and inspiring. These were ordinary people, made extraordinary by a dynamic and vibrant Christian faith, which carried them through some of the worst circumstances imaginable. C.T. Studd wrote, "I once had another religion, hunting the Bible for hidden truths, but no obedience, no sacrifice. Then came the change. The real thing came before me. Words became deeds. The commands of Christ became not merely Sunday recitations, but battle calls to be obeyed. Assent to creed was born again into decisive action of obedience." Hudson Taylor states his life is based on three facts. There is a living God. He has spoken the Bible. He means what he says, and he'll do all that he has promised. Now that's a good three-point pillar for anyone's life. Hudson Taylor wrote of the intense longing for God that gripped him, of the conviction that never left him that he was called to China. Hudson Taylor agonized in prayer for China, sometimes praying through the night. He wrote of wrestling with his unbelief and how the Lord conquered my unbelief, and I surrendered myself to God for his service. The Great Commission is not an option to be considered. It is a command to be obeyed. At the end of his long life, Hudson Taylor could declare that the sun had never risen upon him in China without finding him at prayer. That's quite something. The battle is the Lord's, and he will conquer. We may fail. We do fail continually. But he never fails. The pioneer missionaries of the 19th century were inspired by most decisive, positive, optimistic faith. They were absolutely convinced that the Lord who gave the Great Commission would ensure that it would be fulfilled. The will of God will never lead you, where the grace of God cannot keep you. When after 7 years of laboring in China, Robert Morrison saw the first Chinese convert, he wrote, "May he be the first fruits of a great harvest, one of millions who shall believe and be saved." Now remember, he'd been working 7 years without having a convert. When his first convert came, was he discouraged? No. He saw this as just the beginning of millions. And today there are well over 100 million Christians in China. Scotland's first foreign missionary, Alexander Duff, declared, "Oh, what promises are ours if we only had faith to grasp them. What a promise is that in the Great Commission. Go and make disciples of all nations. And lo, I'm with you even to the end of the world." We go forth. amongst the hundreds of millions of the nations. We find gigantic systems of idolatry and superstition consolidated for thousands of years. They tower as high mountains. But what does faith say? Believe and it shall be. And if any church on earth will realize that faith, to that church will honor belong of evangelizing the nations and bringing down the mountains. When after 7 years of labor in India, William Carey was able to witness the conversion of Krishnapal, his first convert from Hinduism, Carey declared the divine grace which changed one Indian's heart can obviously change 100,000. Indeed, there are millions of Christians in India today. Carey declared that the work to which God has set his hands will infallibly prosper. We only want men and money to fill this country with the knowledge of Christ. We're neither working at uncertainty nor afraid of the result. Christ must reign until Satan has not won 1 inch of territory. God's cause will triumph. In the words of William Carey's historic sermon, which launched the modern missionary movement, expect great things from God. Attempt great things for God. By God's grace, Carey was able to successfully campaign against the Hindu practice of suti, where widows were burned alive in the funeral pyres of husbands. Carey also ended the practice of burning lepers alive. William Carey established the first newspaper ever printed in an Oriental or Eastern language, introduced the first steam engine to India, pioneered lending libraries, make knowledge available, introduced savings banks. You think, savings banks? What's that got to do with missions? To enable poor people to afford to buy their own home. He pioneered forest conservation. 50 years before the government initiated forest conservation, he was instituting forestry conservation. He established the first Christian college in Asia, Serampore College, which is still operating today, with 2,500 students. He succeeded in producing and distributing over 200,000 Bibles, New Testaments or Gospels, in 36 languages. He translated the Bible to 6 languages, whole Bibles, and New Testaments and Gospels into another 29. That's just staggering. The most prolific Bible translator in history. By God's grace, through the ministry of Mary Slessor, the killing of twins ceased. Slave trading in Calabar was eradicated. Drunkenness, killing, and witchcraft diminished. Many schools and churches were established, and most of the people of Calabar came to embrace the gospel of Christ, and we've had people from Calabar coming to our Great Commission course. The first public Christian worship service in New Zealand was conducted on Christmas Day, 1814, by Samuel Marsden. By 1845, it was reported that 98% of the Maoris had embraced Christianity. By the time John Williams was clubbed to death and eaten by cannibals on the island of Erromonga, 1839, he had already succeeded in transforming scores of islands by the scriptures he had translated, by the schools he had established, by the churches he had built, and by the many thousands of islanders who had come to salvation in Christ. John Williams had been converted 25 years earlier by a sermon based on what is a man profited if he should gain the whole world and lose his own soul? What shall a man give in exchange for soul? True to that verse in Matthew 16 that he had heard on the night of his conversion, 1814, John Williams found his life by losing it for Christ. Frank Patton followed in his father John Patton's footsteps, became a missionary to the island where his father had been forced to flee for his life 34 years before. During his ministry there, Frank was blessed to see the whole population of Tana won for Christ. On several islands in the Pacific, they've got a monument saying, before the missionary came, there were no Christians. When they left, there were no heathen. Similarly, Robert Morrison at George Singer's son, John Morrison, follow in his footsteps and pour his heart and soul into the work of bringing the gospel to the people of China. All of Adoniram's 5 surviving children, Adoniram Judson had 10 children, 5 died young in the field, but of the 5 surviving children, they all grew up to distinguish themselves in Christian service. Robert Moffat, who produced the first complete translation of the Bible into an African language, had the joy of seeing 5 of his 7 children actively involved in missionary service. His daughter Mary marrying David Livingstone, possibly one of the most famous missionaries of all time. His son John Moffat established the first mission station amongst the Malabi, close to ours, brought up in Rhodesia. Two of C.G. Studd's daughters, who had been born in China, came out and joined him with their husbands in his Heart of Africa mission in the Congo, including Edith, who became Edith Buxton, marrying a very effective missionary who translated the Bible into Abyssinian language later in Abyssinia. One of many fruits of William Wilberforce's lifelong crusade against the slave trade was that Samuel Ajay Crowther, who was born in Yorubaland in 1807, the same year that Great Britain abolished the slave trade, Samuel Crowther became the first African bishop of the Church of England. Born in Yorubaland, he was captured at age 13 by Arab slavers, African slavers, sold to a Portuguese trader for transport across the Atlantic, rescued by a British naval squadron in 1822, put ashore at Freetown, where he was evangelized and taught. From 1809, the British government was mobilizing its navy to search suspected slave ships, even foreign vessels on the high seas. For a century, the Royal Navy was dedicated to setting the captives free, going far beyond clearing the oceans of slave ships. They boldly sailed up uncharted rivers and creeks, storming slave stockades, freeing captives at every turn. Here's just one shipload of slaves rescued off Zanzibar by the Royal Navy. Great Britain dedicated its resources to fighting and opposing the slave trade. They spent millions of pounds in suppressing the slave trade, and they sacrificed a lot of blood in fighting to set the captives free. The West African country of Sierra Leone was established by British evangelicals to serve as a haven for freed slaves. Britain invested vast amounts of money in developing Sierra Leone as a free and independent state where liberated slaves could settle. In Sierra Leone, Samuel Crowther was converted to Christ. He is educated both in Sierra Leone and England. About the third year of my liberation from the slavery of man, I was convinced of another, worse state of slavery, that of sin and Satan. I was admitted to the visible Church of Christ here on earth as a soldier to fight manfully under his banner against spiritual enemies. 1843, Samuel was ordained as a Church of England minister for service with the Church Missionary Society. He was one of the leaders of a successful missionary venture that took him and several former slaves back to their native Yoruba land, where vigorous Christianity was established. One of his first converts that he baptized was his own mother, who took the name Hannah. She was Hannah, given to the Lord, received back from the Lord. His language, Yoruba, became the first African language to be used for Church of England's liturgy and worship, and he did the translation. Yoruba Christianity was distinctively Protestant and evangelical in the Anglican style. Crowther led his converts in burying or destroying their charms, fetishes, and idols. He is ordained as the first African bishop of the Church of England in an overflowing Canterbury Cathedral in 1864. Directed to undertake a mission along the Niger River to follow up on the Niger expedition of 1841, which was led by Wilberforce's successor, Foxwell Buxton, the evangelical leader in Parliament who was leading the anti-slavery crusade. His expedition was to overcome the ravages of the slave industry entrenched there. Of the 145 Europeans on the expedition, 130 were struck down with malaria and 40 died on one mission. Yet the expedition succeeded in establishing a missionary center at Fora Bay for training liberated slaves to evangelize West Africa, built on the very place where the slave market had once stood. The rafters of the roof were made almost entirely from the masts of old slave ships. Samuel Crowther was one of the first four students to graduate from Fora Bay, sub-Saharan Africa's first university. He diligently labored to bring the gospel to the different tribes along the Niger River. He produced biblical tracts and scripture texts dealing with witchcraft and charms, and also common ground between the Quran and the scriptures to produce gospel presentations to win Muslims to Christ. He had correspondence with King Ogara of Panda and managed to convince him of the need to bring the gospel to his people. He was effective in opposing slavery, witchcraft, and Islam. He won many converts amongst the Noop and the Hausa. He worked so effectively that today there are over 18 million Anglicans in Nigeria. That's 18 times more Anglicans are in church in Nigeria every Sunday in the whole of British Isles and North America combined. The biggest concentration of Anglicans, Church of England in the world. Missions is the lifeblood of the church. And it's absolutely essential that our congregations and our families be presented with these and many other inspiring examples of those that God blessed in such extraordinary ways. We need to read these examples, feeding our minds and our souls with examples of excellence. And I pray that these few selected adventures and sacrifices and exploits and pictures will whet your appetite to read the Greatest Century of Missions book and to obtain more missionary biographies. To start the lifelong habit of making time to feed your mind and your soul with what has been described as the noblest object that can engage the enthusiasm of man, the salvation of millions. May God be pleased to use the Greatest Century of Missions to inspire a new generation of missionaries to expect great things from God and to attempt great things for God. One who answered that call was David Rainier, whose journal includes this prayer. Here I am, send me. Send me to the rough, to the savage pagans of the wilderness. Send me from all that's called comfort on earth. Send me even to death itself, if it be but in thy service, and to promote thy kingdom. In the words of C.T. Studd, you only have one life, and it'll soon be passed. Only what's done for Jesus Christ will last.